Up next, Truth Quest with Melody. that was Poker Face, and I'd Rather Die, and this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And tonight I have for a guest Charles Giuliani. Is that how you pronounce it, Charles?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I've got used to saying the other pronunciation, unfortunately. So, and anyway, Charles is a talk show host on Republic Broadcasting Network, and he has a program once a week, and it's called Truth Hurts. And he has degrees in history, theology, education, and his hobbies include biking, hiking, playing guitar, writing and collecting fossils, ancient artifacts, and meteorites. He's written 20 self-published books on subjects ranging from alternative science, history, politics, and theology. He's worked in public broadcasting for 9 years and started out with his own local cable access TV and later moved into the radio broadcasting. His passion is the pursuit of truth, no matter how unpleasant or unpopular it might be. And he's quite versed in 9/11 and the New World Order and some ancient history and other eclectic topics. So, good evening, Charles.
Yeah. You know, is there a way to turn up the volume on your end?
Okay. Is that better?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, we've got a board that we're fixing to change because this one, so we can upgrade to newer equipment. Yay.
Maybe I need to turn the volume up on my phone.
Okay.
Like you faded again.
Okay. Is that any better?
Could you do it a little bit louder?
Okay. How's that?
You know, I do have a volume control on my phone. It's funny because when I first talked to you before the show, you sounded fine.
Okay, right. But that was...
But maybe because you're going through a mixer now or
right,
something.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sometimes I have that problem with some people's phones, too. So.
Well, obviously you're hearing me okay, right?
Yeah, I don't have any problem with you.
Huh. Hold on 1 second. Let me just check the volume control on my phone, see if that helps out.
Okay, and while we're at it, I will go ahead and read the disclaimer if I can find it. Somebody has moved it again.
I think that's as high as it goes.
Okay. Well, I was going to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of KHEN's staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And so you're still having a problem.
Yeah, it's very low. But, you know, I'm a blabber anyway, so big blabber mouth, so, you know.
Well,
I'll probably be doing most of the talking anyway, so.
Well, then I'll let you go ahead and get started on that. Where would you like to go with this?
Yeah, well, you know, if I'm blabbing too much, you can just yell really loud.
All right.
Don't hesitate to interrupt. Now, see, just then when you said all right, that sounded...
Okay, well, maybe it's the direction I'm speaking on the mic.
Yeah, you're sounding better now.
Okay, we'll try it that way. Okay,
there we go.
All right.
Anyway, I have had my ears checked recently, so I know it's not old age creeping in yet. Not losing my hearing yet.
Okay, great.
But losing my mind. I mean, we can go anywhere you want, really. I'm pretty flexible. But one of my main topics that I focus on quite a bit is 9/11.
Right, and
it's something I've done. Well, I've done a lot of research on a lot of different things, but 9/11 has been my focus as far as the political aspect goes.
Okay.
I've known that we've been headed toward this global system of tyranny, or the New World Order, as it's called, since the early 90s. And so, having become aware of that, in fact, what first opened my eyes was a popular book that many who follow this are well aware of. It's None Dare Call It Conspiracy by Gary Allen. Having read that, I realized early on that, there's something else going on behind the scenes other than what we see on the surface, and has been that way for, decades on end.
Mm-hmm.
And so, having been made aware of that, I've been following politics ever since, and when events have unfolded, such as, the Oklahoma City bombing, for example, the 1993 attempted bombing of the World Trade Center, and other similar events, I recognize these things as part of this ongoing agenda. And so when 9/11 happened, even before the evidence came in, I already knew in my mind what was going on. I knew that this was another government-orchestrated fiasco. And, you know, I wasn't surprised as the months rolled on and the evidence started to come in that, yeah, you know, for example, the 19 named hijackers were not on those planes. That some of, you know, several of them have been found to still be alive. Their names weren't on the original passenger manifest lists. And then, even more strange than that, even if they were on the planes, there's no accounting for how those planes were flown with such professional skills when none of them had the skills to even fly a small Cessna. You know, their own trainers, for example, Salem El Hamzi, said to have been the hijacker pilot for Flight 77, yet his instructor from Sorby's Flying School in San Diego said he was so bad that just 6 weeks before 9/11, he told him he could never go up in the air with him again. And yet he is supposed to have undergone, undertaken the most difficult maneuver of all those planes that day. It, you know, did that downward spiral turn of 270 degrees and leveled off literally just a few feet off the ground for its last several hundred feet of its journey and held that thing steady, didn't even, you know, scratch the front lawn, and yet experienced pilots with 20, 30 years under their belt said they could never have pulled that off, certainly not with a commercial airliner, maybe with, you know, a military jet. And the whole point is that plane underwent 7 or 8 G's of force as it came down the way it did. And that would have rendered the entire crew and you know, all the passengers unconscious. How did this guy maintain consciousness, you know, having not been a military-trained pilot and gone through the training to, you know, to endure something like that? I mean, it's just, no matter how you look at this thing, it just, it comes up peanuts like a Snickers bar, you know? There's no explaining this. But, you know, before we go even into more detail on this, and I don't know if you wanted to spring off into other areas, too.
Yeah, I'd like to, too, because I know that, you know, you're well-versed in numerous areas, and,
sure.
And
well, yeah, we can take this wherever we want to go, but, but I, you know, I don't know how much your listeners are familiar with this topic. I'm probably preaching to the choir.
Meaning, go ahead.
But, no, I was just going to say, you know, even before you start pulling 9/11 apart and looking at it in detail, when you get the historical perspective of how our government has been pulling things like this for decades, understanding 9/11 is a piece of cake. It's just business as usual, you know. We were lied into World War One. For that matter, even before that, we were lied into the Spanish-American War.
Mm-hmm.
And the government orchestrated the bomb that was set off on the USS Maine, and they blamed it on the Spanish, and that was used to go to war against them. And, of course, we annexed Cuba, and for a while anyway. We got the Philippines. We got Puerto Rico. That was quite a profitable venture right there. And it's been that way ever since. You know, every war we fought, World War II, you know, we were tricked into it with the Pearl Harbor thing. It was a genuine attack. The government didn't orchestrate that as far as, you know, actually dropping the bombs, obviously. But they facilitated in the sense that, you know, they annoyed the Japanese. They deliberately set them off so that they would counterattack. And what we had done is we were sending lend-lease to China while claiming to be neutral in the war. And we put an embargo on Japan. And that was the final straw. And then, you know, we had the purple code cracked. We knew the day and the hour they were going to strike. We sat back and let it happen. So then we could turn around and play on that as great, you know, war propaganda to anger the American public, turn them against the Japanese. We did it in World War One. You know, we used propaganda to turn the American people against the Germans to get us into that war. We set them up with the Lusitania. It just goes on and on like this to get us into Vietnam. We staged what turns out now never even happened. You know, the Gulf of Tonkin incident. We weren't attacked, but even if we were, we were trying to provoke them to counterattack. You know, we were sending incursions into northern Vietnam for 6 months prior to that incident. So even if they did attack, it would have been justified. You know, they claimed it was unprovoked attack. But the truth is, they never even attacked. And, you know, we can go back to the Korean War, the same thing there. The North Koreans did not attack South Korea. It was actually the other way around. With U.S. aid, South Korea attacked the North. You know, it's so disgusting when you start looking into detail. You know, every war that we've fought in the past 100 years has been a fraud, every single one of them. It's been about annexation of territory, stealing resources, driving already poor populations further into poverty, overthrowing legitimately elected leaders and replacing them with tyrants and fattening their pockets with you know, big wads of cash to keep them compliant, to sell out their public so we can continue to steal their resources and employ them at dirt wages, and, you know. And now, of course, we're the target. Now we're being driven into poverty, as we have done to other nations around the world. Now they're working on us. They're bringing us down to third world status.
But didn't it also, a lot of these incidents, though, weren't done just because of us? It was in concert with other groups or people around the world, was it not?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's the central banking cartel that's behind all of this. And, you know, what's been going on for the past 100, almost 200 years now is they've been, you know, setting up central banks in country after country all across Europe now. You know, every European country has a central bank, United States, of course, the Soviet Union, or Russia, China. Now Iraq has one, of course, because we've gone in there. Iran and Syria, of course, don't have central banks. That's one of the reasons they want to go in there. You know, they're called the Axis of Evil because they don't have control over them. They're independent. They want to hijack those countries, install their central banks, and so that once they do that, now they own them. Whoever owns a nation's monetary system and operates it owns that country. That's all there is to it. So if they can get their central bank and their income tax established over there as well, now they have a means to pick the public purse and get the public to fund their own slavery, basically, is what it is. So, yeah, you have all these nations at the leadership, highest levels of leadership, working in concert together, and they don't have a choice because their banks are controlled by this same entity, you see. So no nation, even if they wanted to go against this system, they can't. They can't afford to because they will economically boycott them, and they will dry up and wither away the next day.
So what you are describing is a system.
It is a what?
A system.
Oh, sure.
Right.
It's a monstrously evil, corrupt system that, you know, as far as the leaders are concerned, there's no escape from it. But as it turns out, most world leaders actually favor this. They were groomed early on before they even got into office to pledge their allegiance to this. So it's no problem for most of them. There are some that don't like it, but they still go along because they realize that if they didn't, they'd be cutting their own head off, so to speak, you know.
Right, right.
So this is what's been going on. You know, every time we invade a country, they always make it out to look like, you know, we're bringing freedom and democracy, when in reality we're destroying freedom and democracy, driving these people into poverty, putting a chokehold on them, putting them into debt, and making them slaves to this emerging system. And, you know, because they have total control over the media, the illusion, you know, is still being created, and a lot of people are still falling for it. A lot have woken up because of the outrageous abuses of this administration. People are finally catching on. But there's still a lot of them that are totally in the dark, that are buying the lies that are spun for us by these media pundits that, again, that they totally control. And that's reinforced in academia. They control, you know, the educational establishments, and they do that primarily through grant money. You know, most of the colleges and universities in this country are dependent upon grant money. They know full well that if they allowed their professors to speak freely about what's really going on and actually educate their students, they'd be cut off from their funding.
Yeah.
So naturally, they're going to tell the professors, shut up, you're out of here. And we've seen this in action. We saw it just a year ago in September with Professor Stephen Jones from Brigham Young University. He's the physicist that, you know, examined some of the steel and found that it was loaded with thermite residue from the World Trade Center, proving that it was, you know, a controlled demolition that brought those buildings down, that they used explosives. And once he started coming forward with this publicly and started to get a lot of attention, next thing you know, he gets a notice from, you know, his check signers at the central office. You know, either take an early retirement or going to fire you.
Well, one of my first books that I got into that kind of helped wake me up was a book called Cloak of Green, and it was about the non-governmental organizations and their part that they play around the world in facilitating numerous things, and I had no idea how huge Canada was in this arena. Have you ever read the book?
Not that one, no.
Uh-huh. Well, it's Elaine Dewar that wrote it, and the reason why I read that book was it had to do with, I started looking in a little bit into the Rockefellers and ran into, we have a person that lives a county away or whatever, or owned property away, a county away, and his name was Maurice Strong. And so that...
Well, yeah, the Rockefellers definitely have played a major role in this. In fact, just a few years ago, back in 2002, David Rockefeller, I'm amazed that guy is still alive. He's well into his 80s now. He's still playing the game. Anyway, in that book, Memoirs, 2002, he actually boasted that him and his family are indeed engaged and have been, you know, for over 150 years, engaged in a conspiracy, collaborating with other powerful elitist bankers and financiers from around the world. You know, he said, to those who would accuse me and my family of conspiring to create a world government, I plead guilty and I'm proud of it.
Okay, then you've got to be aware of Maurice Strong then. No?
Oh, yeah, I am aware of him. I just haven't read that particular book yet.
Okay, right.
For sure.
Right, because, I mean, because he does a lot of work with Rockefellers.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Right, okay.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. So, you started a little early before a lot of the people that I'm aware of getting wise to it, although I do know that there's people that have been wise to what's going on around the world.
Well, you know, it helps if you've been personally burnt by the system. And that's what did it. You know, I was, as you mentioned in the early opening of the show, you know, I was a theology major, and I got burned really bad by corrupt organized religion. And that was a real eye-opener for me when I saw how monstrously corrupt that was at the top. And it wasn't just the particular denomination I was involved in. I found out they're all the same. You know, I was in touch with ministers of various denominations, and they were telling me the same nightmare stories going on with them. And so I realized that, yeah, this has to be a whole nationwide thing. It has to be, all these churches seem to be doing this. So it led me into, you know, some interesting avenues of research, and I finally figured out why that's the case. There's a couple major reasons for that. One of them is simply, you know, this 501c3 tax-exempt corporation status that these religious steepled corporations have. It's a contractual agreement they've made with the government whereby, you know, they agree not to speak against the government, and the government allows them to have their members that contribute to them every week write off their contributions on their taxes. This was very appealing to them because that meant, oh, wow, people would be more likely to give bigger donations if they know they can write them off. You get it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they didn't need a 501c3, and they still don't, to be tax exempt. You know, the Constitution grants them that already. But this little scheme that they came up with, it started back in the 60s. Again, they just said, look, you know, yeah, you don't need a 501c3, but if you get one, you know, your members can write off, blah, blah, blah. And so, at first, it didn't seem like a big deal. Sure, oh, yeah, why not? You know, we're liable to get bigger donations. But as time went on, they began putting stipulations on them. It was actually already in the contract, but they weren't enforcing it right from the start. It would have looked too obvious, you know. But as the years have gone on, and more churches jumped on the bandwagon with this thing, the illusion was created that churches had to have a 501c3. And then as time went on, they started putting more and more stipulations and, you know, more and more control and tightening the noose. Now it's at a point where you don't have religious freedom at all in this country anymore. People don't realize this. These systems are totally locked in with the government. You will never, never hear from any pulpit in this country any mention of the New World Order, 9/11 being an inside job. If you do, I guarantee within a week that church will be shut down because they're in violation of their contractual agreement.
That's if they are all churches?
All of them. There's no exception. You could not, if you wanted, if you wanted to rent out a hall downtown in your town and put a sign out front, you know, Smithfield Fellowship or something, they would shut you down tomorrow once they found out that you were a religious organization and you weren't a 501c3. They have no basis for doing that. There's no law that enables them to do that, but they do it anyway because they know they can get away with it because people have no clue what's going on. It's just like the income tax. You know, there's no law that enables the IRS to pick one-third of your paycheck from your pocket every week. It's extortion. But they've created this urban legend that they have the authority to do it, and everybody knows, oh, if I don't do it, I'm going to have the SWAT team after me. But that's because you don't know your rights. And they've created this fear factor. The IRS has admitted, by the way, there's been several former IRS, notice former, they don't admit this when they're still working for the IRS, but several former IRS commissioners have admitted, yeah, you know, the IRS operates on 99% bluff. I'll argue they operate on 100% bluff, but that's an astonishing admission, you know.
Uh-huh.
And this is why people like, you know, Ron Paul have talked about shutting the IRS down. It's a scam. So is the Federal Reserve, that is the heart of the IRS, you know.
Well, you make it sound like everything's an illusion then.
Well, it really is. When you understand that this goal is for total and complete control of every aspect of our lives, then it only makes sense that they've hijacked everything. They have to. If they leave one avenue open, then the whole thing would fail. So they realized very early on that they had to get control of education. They've got that. Washington dictates, you know, on a nationwide scale, they dictate everything to do with so-called public education. It's not public, it's private. It's the government that privately runs it from Washington. If you want to get even more technical, it's really Wall Street that runs it via Washington. But, you know, there's no local control of our schools anymore. That's gone. That's been long gone for a long time. They dictate everything. And they understand they don't have power to do this. The Constitution sets out very clearly what the function of the central government is. And then it says anything not stipulated here is to be relegated to the people and the states. In other words, control of everything else that's not mentioned here is up to the states and the people in their local communities. So it not only does not give them power to control education, it denies them that power. But here's Washington today controlling education completely. This started in 1965. LBJ was the first one to pass federal legislation dealing with education. And it's been downhill ever since. Of course, we had Clinton with his IDEA Act, and now we have Junior with his No Child Left Behind, which is a complete scam. All they mean by that is No Child Left Behind from their control, and also from the military meat market, because that's what they've turned education into now. Bush, as a part of the No Child Left Behind Act, requires all high schools around the country to turn over all names, addresses, and phone numbers to the local draft board. Isn't that interesting?
I've heard that, yes.
Unbelievable. Parents have no clue what's going on. I mean, I could go on all night just talking about that, what they've done. You know, they've created this special ed fiasco. They try to get as many kids as they possibly can designated as having a, quote, learning disability, or ADD or ADHD. You know, it's even been admitted by the American Psychiatric Society that there is no basis, no scientific basis for an ADD or ADHD diagnosis. They really don't have anything firm or solid that they all agree on, or that even a significant number agree on, you know, as to what it is. But that doesn't stop them every year from diagnosing millions of more kids and getting them on Ritalin or whatever other psychotropic med they choose, which messes these kids up, turns them into zombies, dumbs them down. But, you know, they pass because once they're on an IEP, which is an individualized education program, they can twist and contort tests that they give them. They can actually help them cheat, give them hints, make it impossible for them to fail. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's great for the teacher because now the kid behaves. All he can do is sit there and soil his diapers, sitting in the corner drooling on himself, you know, because he's so doped up. But the teacher loves it because the kid's well-behaved. Mom and dad love it because they don't have to deal with him anymore. He just sits in his bedroom until it's time to go to bed and, you know, sits in front of the TV set. Mom and dad are too busy because they're working 60, 70, 80 hours a week now just to fill their gas tank so they can go to work. I mean, look at the system. I'm not being pessimistic. This is the reality of it.
No, I understand.
This is a George Orwellian nightmare. The government has intruded itself into every aspect of our lives, and we can't even breathe anymore unless they give us permission. Especially under this administration. So many laws have been passed now that the Constitution is absolutely decimated, and yet people think they're still free. Freedom do you have anymore? You can't go out and get a job unless you're a certified toilet flusher. You know, you got to... You know, I mean, everything is hijacked. It's unbelievable. You know, it used to be, if you wanted to become a lawyer or something, that used to be a respectable job, by the way. You know, all you had to do is work as an apprentice under a senior, professional, and you were paid a small stipend, but it was enough that you could live on, you know. But you didn't care because you knew in another year or two or three or whatever, after working under this professional, you would be well-trained and you'd be off on your own now. Today, you don't get paid while you're training. You have to pay them, and you pay them handsomely. I mean, now you come out of school 4, 6, 8 years, whatever, you bought yourself a house. In some cases, two or three or four houses. for the price of your education. So you're buying a job. Oh, they rigged it up so it doesn't look like that's what it is, but that's exactly what it is. You're buying a job, and it's going to take you the next 15, 20, 30 years to pay your job off. All the while, you're trying to pay a house off. That's going to take you 15, 20, 30 years. Even if you've got a really good-paying job, you're still strapped.
Now, I've been figuring this system out myself, and you're right.
You know, you want to be a doctor. You don't own your profession anymore. They own you. They tell you what you can do, when you can do, if you can do, how you can do, who you can see, when you can see them. You can't go to their home anymore. They have to come to you. You have to be insured because if they trip on the ice coming into the door, you're liable. I mean, it's just out of control.
Right. Now, in fact, I've been working in an industry that's been unregulated, and they've just now starting to regulate it. And, of course, their reason behind it is, you know, somebody claiming that, you know, there's prostitution involved in it. Well, there's
prostitution, all right, in more form than one. And then, you know, the medical profession, as I'm sure you know, has no interest in your health. I mean, you might have a doctor here or there that genuinely cares, but he's still limited to what he can do and can't do. But for the most part, the whole profession is all geared around money. They deliberately raise the cost of the thing through the roof so that most people can't afford it. They want this. They love this chaos because now it can justify the government stepping in again and being the hero. This is their game. It's called the Hegelian dialectic. You know, you create a problem and you come along with a solution, and you created the problem in the first place, but the people don't realize that. So they fall for your solution, which is to give them even more control, suck more money out of taxes from you. That's what Hillary's going to propose when she's in there, and I'm sure they're going to rig it so she wins because our elections are a fraud. But, you know, this is her big theme. She wants socialized medicine. Now, there's no question our medical establishment is a farce. It needs complete revamping, and people need help, you know, with the outrageous cost of health care. But what they've done is deliberately created this disaster so that they can come in with more socialism. The government will save the day. We'll have what we got in Europe and in Canada. See, they don't have to pay for their health care. But guess what? Your taxes go through the roof even more. So now, instead of working until July 15th, now you'll be working to September 15th for the government. You know, they'll take out three-quarters of your – that's what they do in Europe. People pay about 66% of their income in taxes.
Well, we do, too, but it's just done through
more. Well, sure, yeah, if you – yeah, I'm talking the federal. But, if you add up local, state, and federal, sure, you're paying well over – you know, it's amazing because this country started on the basis of unfair taxation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet that tax, the tea tax, only amounted – if you were a heavy tea drinker, it only amounted to between 1% and 3% of your income, and it wasn't a direct tax. It was an indirect tax, so you didn't have to pay it if you didn't want it. You just don't buy the tea. Today, this is a direct tax. It's imposed upon you, and it's over 50% collectively, all your tax burden. Sure. So, I mean, we've gone way beyond what anything that the pioneers, you know, the colonists had to deal with. And look what they're putting up with. I mean, they didn't put up with that relatively minor oppression back then. Can you imagine? Look what we're putting up with today. It's unbelievable. I guess the Prozac and the Ritalin is working quite well.
And the television.
The living dead.
So, okay, it really sounds kind of pessimistic, but then yet, look what you're doing, and why are you doing what you're doing? I mean, you have to have some optimism about something. Am I correct?
Well, having been a theology major didn't totally destroy my faith in God. I still believe that, you know, ultimately there's going to be retribution coming. And so in that sense, you can always feel bad for these scoundrels. I personally don't, but, you know, they're going to get what's coming to them. There's no court in this world that's going to hold them accountable because they got them all rigged. They own the court system, you know. But I believe in higher court, and I believe they're going to get a hundredfold back what they've dealt out. So they better enjoy it while they can because their time is running out.
You know, I don't even know really where to go with this because it really is that rigged. I mean, when you really start studying.
It sounds like, oh, yeah, you're so negative, you're so pessimistic. But no, look at it, folks. Look at it. We now have our dollar at the lowest it's ever been in all of American history. I mean, you know, you wonder why gold is so high? Gold hasn't moved. Gold is a mountain. It stands still. The ocean rises and falls around it, but the mountain doesn't move. It's the dollar that's dropping. That's why gold is so high. They don't tell you that, though. They word it another way. Oh, the gold has risen, too. No, it hasn't moved. It's the dollar. Again, you know, we're dropping against third world currencies right now. We got the Brazilian dollar that it's almost level with us, a third world currency.
Yeah, but that's also like, I don't know whether it was Rockefeller, but I do know that Strong had pretty much stated that it was bringing us down to the third world level instead
right.
of bringing.
Right. Sure. Right.
So we're
in order to introduce this well, ultimately what they want is a global currency, but what they're doing right now as an incremental step toward that is they want to create a regional currency called the Amaro. They want to merge Canada, Mexico, and the United States by 2010. That's already a done deal as far as they're concerned. Bush signed it, you know, 3 years ago. He met with Vicente Fox and the Canadian Prime Minister, and they struck this deal up without the knowledge or consent of the American people or the Mexican people or the Canadian people. This is a sellout of, you know, the people of all three countries. And so as far as they're concerned, it's a done deal unless people wake up and put a stop to this. And they're going to merge these three countries. There isn't going to be a border with Mexico. There's going to be a border with Canada. And, you know, you can forget the Constitution. I mean, it's pretty much decimated now anyway. But this will make it a final and official. There won't be a Constitution anymore. There won't be an American dollar. Of course, American dollar is a fraud to begin with right now. But there won't even be anything that even looks American. They're going to have the Amaro, just like the Euro in Europe, you know.
If you listen to their language carefully, you will notice that they use the term America, and they don't talk about the United States much.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Because they've done everything they can to destroy American sovereignty. That's what they want.
That's
what the New World Order is all about.
Well, the European Union's doing the same thing to Britain.
Oh, sure.
Not?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This all comes from the same source. In fact, for decades now, it's amazing people can't see this because they're not hiding it. You know, they get off on this, that they can actually discuss openly in a public forum decades ahead of time what their plans are. And then later when they start implementing them, and people who have been paying attention and know what they're doing because they have, you know, listened to these statements from years ago, they'll call you crazy and paranoid or a nut job. You know what you're talking about. But we do know what we're talking about. You know, Zbigniew Brzezinski in his 1970 book, Between Two Ages, talked about how the plan was in the coming years to bring nations together regionally, get them used to interacting with each other, either politically, militarily, it doesn't matter. You know, some of these regional unions are military in nature, like NATO. Others are economic in nature, like NAFTA, you know. But it doesn't matter what the initial reason is for bringing them together. You just get nations used to working together, and then ultimately you bring them together politically as well as militarily or vice versa, you know, whichever it started out as. Get them used to functioning as one unit, you know. Introduce a regional constitution, which is what the European Union has already introduced. They have a European constitution. They have a European parliament now. They meet and decide on issues, and then they become law in the various member states. That's what the American Union is going to be, the North American Union. And then ultimately, as Brzezinski said, and he's not the only one, Kissinger talked about this, several other world leaders, and, Nixon, too, was another one that talked about this. And then ultimately the plan was to merge these regional unions together under one single global banner. That's what the UN is all about. You know, if people would step back and look at the broader historical perspective, I mean, you can see how this has been the plan. Right after World War One, these same banking families, I've been passing on the torch from generation to generation, but back right after World War One, they were the ones who financed the Versailles Treaty, you know, helped get that meeting put together. And one of the things that came out of that, of course, was the League of Nations. And it was hoped that that was going to be the catalyst for world government. Well, it didn't work. It failed. The U.S. wouldn't join. They had anticipated that. So they left the door wide open for another world war in case this first one wasn't enough to bring the nations to desperation and realize, oh, we've got to have world government to prevent another world war. So they left the door wide open as part of that Versailles Treaty to make Germany responsible for that war. They put all the pressure on them to make these huge reparation payments, right? Well, they knew that Germany wasn't going to be able to do that. And to ensure, to make their situation even worse as the 20s rolled on, they introduced the Young Plan, the Dawes Plan, which was loans to help them make their payments. But, you know, anybody with half a brain can realize that when you're in debt, taking more loans isn't going to get you out of debt. It only provides temporary relief. It's like a credit card, right?
Right.
You can get purchasing power with a credit card, but in the long run, your debt problem is worse than ever, right?
Right.
And that was what it was designed to do. So, you know, by the time Hitler got into power, the German mark, whereas it was equal with the British pound right after World War One, now it had sunk to 1/20 billionth of the English pound. This was all by design. It was so bad that, you know, you don't hear about this much in the history books, but they don't want you to know because then you realize the same thing's happening here. But 800,000 people died during this time. These were working people. They died from starvation. Their wives were going to their husband's place of work every hour in the hour to get their husband's meager pay, you know, 80 billion marks. That's, you know, that's an example of what they were getting per hour. That's how bad the German mark had sunk. And, you know, that would only buy them maybe half a potato or something at the market.
Well, they're mentally preparing us for this, too. They're already starting to speak of food shortages and things
of that sort. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, look at, you know, gas is so high right now. Truck drivers, heck, they're paying even more for diesel. Diesel used to be cheaper than gas. Now they're paying, you know, already $4. They're talking about gas going up to $4. So diesel probably up $5-6. And, you know, truckers can't turn a profit over with this kind of outrageous extortion because it's costing them more than what they're making.
Well, that, I mean, isn't that what kind of what the Trans-Texas Corridor is about? Is it kind of breaking the trucking unions and the longshoremen?
It's so disgusting when you realize that this is all being done deliberately. This is not some unforeseen consequence, or it's not even bad management. It's deliberate.
Right.
They're taking us down. And, you know, it's not even about profits. Oh, they're making profits off of this, but this goes way beyond profits. Because, you know, if all they wanted was money, they, all they have to do is print it. That's all they do. That's what the banking system we have in place now is. That's what it's all about. It's just printing money out of thin air. So they could just keep printing it. They don't need to do this to get money. What they're doing is sucking our wealth. They don't just want more for them. They want less for us because then we're more easily controlled. And ultimately, that is the goal. It's control. This is, goes way beyond killer profits. It's power.
Yeah, but this isn't an old plan. I mean, a new plan. It's an old one, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. What's new about it is it's globally coordinated. Before, it was one tyrant over here wanting to rule the world, one tyrant over there. And, you know, none of them really ever succeeded, at least not on a long-scale basis. They intend to succeed this time because it's globally coordinated. They realized in order to get this world system of control and exploit the whole population of the planet, they have to get various groups working together cooperatively, and then they can pull it off. And they'll just have to share this wealth, split it up amongst themselves. But they're trying to limit it down to, you know, as few as they can, and just keep the various world leaders as vassals working under their control.
Well, the interesting part about it is that, you know, they get these people to work for them, even anywhere from the police state to the commercial businessmen. They get them to work for them, but in the end, they will take them down too.
Sure. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's what's so almost laughable is these people think that they're going to ride on the coattails of their buddies that they're working for. They're going to get shafted too. And you know, look what's going on right now in Haiti. This is a very good example of what how this system works. The Haitians, I don't blame them. They're doing what everybody else in every other country on this planet should be doing, but they're too stupid. Haitians know they're getting shafted by their government. They're standing up against them. They know they're being driven into poverty. Haiti should be the last country on the planet, the last region on the planet to be starving because they have some of the richest, in fact, the richest, blackest volcanic soil in the world. But it's all owned by the tobacco companies, you know. So they're rising up against their government because their government is oppressive and they're letting them starve, right? And so what happens? The hero, the UN, steps in to crush out the rebellion. These obnoxious and outlandish outlaws, you know. These people are doing what they should be doing, standing up against tyranny. But you see, the propaganda machine kicks in, and now they make it out like these people are evil, and we have to crush out the rebellion. And the UN is nothing more than the League of Nations with a facelift. It's, you know, created by the same people. John D. Rockefeller Jr. provided the $8 million check to buy the piece of land and build the UN headquarters there in New York. And, you know, look where they put it. They knew that the U.S. was suspicious of the previous entity of the same order, you know, League of Nations. So they figured, this time we'll put the headquarters right on their front doorstep. They won't be suspicious this time. And it worked. American people have, for the most part, fallen for it. But, you know, it's not going quite so well for them as they were hoping. So now the plan is to set up another world war. And, you know, this is what they were trying to do a year ago this past summer with the Israeli attack on Lebanon. They were hoping that that was going to expand into a much broader conflict, that it was going to bring in, you know, Syria and Iran, and that they could have their third and final world war that would bring in world government, because they were going to say, all right, see, we've had three world wars in the past 100 years. Obviously, we need a world government to prevent this from happening again. And even if you don't like it, too bad. We're going to do it because it's the only way to maintain peace and blah, 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 you know.
But they did, they did that with all the world wars, though.
What's that?
They did that with all the world wars. This was going to be, you know, come in to save the day.
Right. But, you know, they had anticipated that this would probably be the case. The first one wouldn't be enough to convince people. The second one wouldn't be enough. But by the third time, you know, the three strikes, you're out thing, by then, it wouldn't matter what the world opinion is. They can just say, hey, look, guys, we gave this, you know, several shots. This is it. We just can't afford to have something like this again. So whether you like it or not, this is the only way to world peace. So they won another world war.
Well, also the UN is kind of like the good cop and whoever's in the tyrant in whichever country
right.
is the bad cop.
But in reality, it's not. I mean, if people did their homework, they'd realize it's not a good cop. That's the way they present themselves. But the UN is every bit as much a tyranny as the Pentagon, you know. In fact, most of the wars that the U.S. has fought in over the past, 60 years, since World War II, have been fought under the auspice of the UN. And, you know, it's funny because people look to the UN as the arbiter of peace. It's been the biggest propagator of war in the history of the world. And, you know, the U.S. is the one that gets blamed all the time because, we are usually the muscle that gets flexed, but it's all done by the direction of the U.N. I mean, that's what Korea was. That's what Vietnam was. Most of the other conflicts that we were involved in World War II, it's all U.N., U.N., U.N.
Right, but this is in concert together, though. I mean,
sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because it's the same people that created the UN that are pulling the strings in Washington, the same ones.
Right.
Yeah. But most people don't see that. They think that, you know, the U.S., the only way to curb the abuses of, you know, the Bush administration, for example, is to call upon the UN, and not realizing that he's doing exactly what the UN wants. I mean, come on, 1 month into office and he's already got us back onto UNESCO. You know, Reagan had taken us off that in the early 80s, and you know, that's one of the first things he did. You really think he's in opposition to the UN, folks, when he puts us back onto UNESCO? And then, of course, he's got our borders wide open. That's what they want. The UN loves that. They want an end to sovereignty. What better way to do that than to sign us on to the North American Union? That's part of their globalization scheme. You know, the World Trade Organization is really big on that stuff, and that's, you know, they operate under the auspice of the UN. I mean, you know, people got to be brain dead not to see this.
What's your take on the wilding of the Americas or Europe or getting into the UN, getting into the taking over the waters and?
Oh, sure. Yeah, mm-hmm. There's been many resolutions that have been introduced over the years, and I mean, they've got their fingerprints on everything. Even the post 9/11 constitution trampling piece of legislation, if you trace it to its root, it actually comes from the UN. Immediately after 9/11, the UN called for all their member states to introduce legislation that would cut back on civil liberties as a means of preventing future terrorism. You know, it's a necessary evil. You know.
I missed that one.
What's that?
I missed that one.
Oh, yeah. I forget the resolution number now, but it was done right after 9/11. And, of course, within a week or two, they were pushing the Patriot Act, and they were able to pull that off because they sent out the phony anthrax mails. That was the government doing that. There's no question about that. You know, the White House staff, including Bush himself, were all put on Cipro 6 weeks prior to the anthrax mailings. It's the only antibiotic that can treat and or prevent contraction of anthrax. And then it comes out a month later, in November of 2001, that the strand that was mailed out was produced only in one place on the entire planet. That very strand was only produced in this one lab. It was an Army research lab in Dietrich, Maryland, working in conjunction with Ames Research Labs in Iowa. And so months later, in June of 2002, the FBI was sued by Judicial Watch. They were demanding that, you know, they release information about their anthrax investigation because it was, you know, just died. It seemed like it died. Nothing was coming out of it. So all the FBI did was release a public statement. this is what they said. We could only go so far in our investigation. We had to stop because we ran into top military secrets. You've got to be kidding me. And, you know, a bunch of other mysterious things here. 13 of the world's top microbiologists died within the first 6 months after the anthrax mailings. You know, that's a little suspicious, wouldn't you say?
Actually, I've heard there's more than that now.
Well, to date now, yeah, there's over three dozen. But, I mean, just in the first 6 months, 13. And then this, too, look at the people who were targeted. You know, Daschle, Leahy, they were two major opponents of Bush at that time, opposed to the Patriot Act. They wanted a 9/11 investigation, which, of course, they blocked for the first 14 months after 9/11. They didn't want an investigation. That's highly suspicious right there. But, I mean, we're supposed to believe that Al-Qaeda was behind the anthrax mailings. Why would they target Bush opponents? Doesn't make sense, does it?
Well, did you... I don't know whether it was you that said this or someone else, but, you know, when Spitzer gave his attention to Obama as opposed to Hillary, isn't that about the time that he got, you know, all the information that came out that brought him down?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, this is all staged ahead of time. To tell you the truth, Obama knows his role, and he reads off a script sheet, too. They all do. I mean, I like him more than the other two bozos, personally. You know what I mean? I like his disposition. And, you know, he seems at least more sincere. But the truth is, even if he is 100% sincere, it doesn't matter. He knows full well there's only so much he can do and say, or he's going to be Kennedy'd, JFK'd, you know.
Well, isn't Zbigniew Brzezinski one of his advisors?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, the same was true with Carter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Carter was a big Rockefeller puppet. But, you know, he's won some respect points with me, probably because he's in his senior years now and wanting to repent of his evil ways. Kind of like Dan Rather, you know. Dan Rather was one of the boys. But now he seems to be turning around. He's really hitting hard. You know, he's talking about how the media in this country is designed to protect the backsides of those in power. Blew me away when he made that statement. And he even, you know, he's sincere when he says, I hate to say this, but I can't exempt myself from this criticism. In other words, he was doing it too. He's admitted it, you know.
Right.
So some of these people have a conscience and they start to speak out. Carter has... you know, come up with a lot of things over the years. In fact, you know, I have to give him credit. You know, he gave back the Panama Canal to Panama. Torrijos, you know, he signed an accord with him, and you know, an agreement with him. And you know, next thing you know, Reagan gets in office, or should I say Daddy Bush. He was the real president during the Reagan years. And, you know, conveniently, Mr. Torrijos' plane crashes, and that was the end of that. That deal went down south, and, you know, we invaded in 89, and that took care of any question now. We seized it. We got it back now. It was supposed to be returned to them in 2000. It never happened. They didn't intend to let it happen. We stole it, and we have made sure through our military dominating the area that we're going to maintain control of that region. By the way, that plane was seen to explode in midair and then crash into the mountain. We were told that it just went out of control and then crashed. Oh, how many times this happens. It's unbelievable.
There's been a lot of them when you start counting them up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
Anywhere from Wellstone and...
Sure. And if it isn't that, it's the assisted suicide program where you shoot yourself twice in the head like, you know, Gary Hart there. Not Gary Hart. What's his name now? The San Jose Mercury reporter.
Gary Webb?
Gary Webb. Gary
right.
Webb, yeah. Gary Hart, oh, goodness. On formulations and so. Yeah, Gary Webb. You know, he was the one who brought a lot out on the CIA's drug trafficking back in the 80s, Reagan-Contra. And you know, twice in the head. You got to be kidding me.
Well, I was just listening recently.
That's determination. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just listening recently that Silly, I can't pronounce his name, now my mind has gone blank. That was another guy that was working probably in the same arena with Gary Webb. Is it Silly Castillo? Is that his name? That was working within the CIA, I believe,
with
the drug
trafficking. Hunter S. Thompson, 2 months later, He supposedly committed suicide. You heard about that, right?
Right, but I never could tell because I'd listened to some phone calls and things of that sort, and I wasn't sure.
Well, I know this. There was the Canadian Globe and Mail had a story the very next day after he died. One of his friends, a reporter for the paper, wrote an article, and he said that Thompson had called him the night before. And he said, I just wanted you to know, he says, I don't put anything past these blankety blanks, you know. He says, I think they're going to try to kill me and make it look like a suicide. But I want you to know ahead of time what's going on. He says, I'm working on a big story to do with 9/11. It's going to blow the lid right off it. He says, I've uncovered some evidence that will prove beyond any doubt that it was, you know, the towers were taken down with explosives. He said, this is more than, you know, anything that's available to the public. This is way beyond, you know. And, but he said, I just wanted to let you know. He says, I know they're following me. They're probably bugging this phone right now. And the next thing you know, the next day, bang, so-called suicide.
Well, in fact, I'd heard part of that phone call because somebody had it. There was a recording of it somewhere.
Really?
Right, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know it was recorded.
Yeah. And I don't know if it was Alex Jones or who that I heard that recording.
Mm.
But what I wasn't quite sure of is, you know, his wife didn't seem to want to press the point too much. And that was, I couldn't quite understand that one.
Well, I mean, look at Kennedy's wife. She really never said anything. In fact, neither did anybody, the rest of the family, except for RFK, but look what they did to him. You know, he said that he was going to reopen his brother's investigation. You know, that was the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody can deny it now. I mean, what the BBC just came out with a couple of weeks ago, it's no question the CIA was behind both of those murders. We have the admission of, you know, first of E. Howard Hunt,
mm-hmm.
and then it now emerges from this BBC report that David Morales also confessed that we did it. You know, I was in Dallas when we killed the blank blank, you know, president. And then I was also in L.A. when we killed the little blankety blank, you know. Proud of it. He was boasting about it.
Well, there was also a video on YouTube or that had, I believe it was a video, it could have been pictures, but I believe it was a video, yeah, of somebody that recognized some of the FBI, not FBI, but CIA.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was referring to. He actually went and interviewed some of the CIA operatives that are still alive that knew these people and played the footage from the hotel there, and they're like, oh, yeah, that's him. Yeah, that's David Morales, sure. Yeah, that's Campbell. I recognize him a mile away, you know. And then, of course, we have, a lot of people don't know this, but back in 1975 when the House Committee on Assassinations had investigated, you know, the CIA's involvement in assassinations, mostly domestic but also foreign, one of the things brought out by then-CIA Director William Colby when they asked him to testify, he actually said that the two CIA agents present in Dallas that day that were in charge locally, he said there were, you know, others that were above them that were calling the shots, but, you know, they were coordinating it on the scene. By the way, you know who we mentioned as the two calling the shots? Alan Dulles, no surprise, CIA director, but you know who else?
Hmm.
David Rockefeller.
Now that I've never heard.
Yeah, he actually mentioned David Rockefeller. Anyway, but then he went on to say this. The two agents on the scene that were coordinating everything was E. Howard Hunt. Well, that's no surprise. He already confessed to that on his deathbed confession. But also George H.W. Bush.
Now that I've heard various people speak of that.
And you know what happened to him the next day?
Mm-mm.
The CIA director, you know, William Colby, got fired. You know who replaced him? George H.W. Bush. And the first thing George H.W. Bush does is to inform the Committee on Assassinations that the CIA is no longer going to cooperate with them because they've been touching on national security matters. So that was the end of their investigation. Without the CIA's cooperation, they couldn't go any further, so they closed it.
Well,
yeah, isn't that interesting?
So you really get into a lot of these stories pretty deep,
oh,
don't
sure.
you?
I always want to know what that lump is under the rug, how it got there. Yeah, I haven't always been pleased with my findings, but hey, you know, the truth hurts. That's why I call my show.
You know, I was listening to one of your programs that was in archives that I thought was really interesting, and it was when you were talking about the gold earlier. It was when you got into the alchemy.
Oh yeah.
I had no idea there was that much information out there as to.
Yeah. Oh, it's fascinating.
Yeah, that I was.
And it makes you wonder, you know, they laugh at it and say, oh, it's crazy. Oh, yes, there were some ancients who claimed that they could do that, but that's just silly. Well, is it silly or do they want you to think it's silly?
Right.
You know, obviously, they don't want you to find that out if it is in fact possible because they couldn't have the stranglehold on you that they have, you know. They want to keep all the world's wealth in their hands. They don't want you to find out that. I mean, you read some of these ancient records and it's not fairy tale. They're relating something that they actually were doing. But then, you know, you start delving into other ancient records. Every part of the world has stories of like this, but probably the clearest ones are from ancient India that talk about air flight. Now, most people would say, oh, that's crazy. Come on, the ancients don't know that. Why? Why couldn't the ancients have had the ability to fly? Because our experts today tell us? Well, you start delving into our experts and finding out who's pulling their strings, and you really can't trust anything the experts say. I mean, that's just the reality of it. We have scientists today who will call you crazy if you say that the Apollo missions never happened, but they didn't happen. I don't know if you've ever looked into that yourself, but that's another thing they've lied to us about.
Well, Alex,
billions of dollars were put into this. You know, you might find this interesting. Just in the past week, I've seen two, maybe three articles. It was just one today that came out, reiterating what was reported about a week ago. NASA is planning to, quote, return to the moon, but won't be able to do so until 2020 because it's working on some technology that will help them jump over some major hurdles that are in their way. Well, wait a minute. If we went there almost four decades ago now, right,
mm-hmm.
with computer technology that, couldn't even keep up with our modern wristwatch, right? If we were so good at it that we managed to send men to the moon six times back then, why can't we do it today with even greater ease with all the advancements in technology that we've had since then? They're telling us that we won't be able to, quote, return to the moon until 2020?
Yeah, but then also George Bush came on and was doing a speech several years ago saying that, you know, we're going to have manned missions going to Mars. I mean, you know that if they've done it six times, they've probably done it 60 times. I mean, that is not human nature for any of them to ever stop. It's just a matter of whether it's...
Well, see, I have no doubt that we've sent unmanned craft there.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the problem. But manned craft to the moon? No. You know, the biggest barrier, of course, is the Van Allen belts, which are highly toxically radioactive. You know, the only time that we're told that man ever journeyed beyond, into or and beyond the Van Allen belts was the Apollo missions. Every other space venture, you know, the shuttle, or be it the Mir space station, all of them have been well within the Van Allen belts, well within the danger zone.
You know, that part I can't say. All I knew, I've just listened to enough testimony by other people. Are you familiar with the Disclosure Project?
Oh, sure.
Okay, and you don't give it any validity then?
No, I don't give much validity to any...
Okay, well,
Well, you know, I kind of opened a can of worms on that. I probably shouldn't have gone down that one because that requires quite a bit of elaboration. But I'll tell you right now, you look at the moon pictures... They're fake.
Mm-hmm. Alex Jones had a guy on today on his program today that was discussing that, who was an expert on that and was one of the guys that was involved with those pictures. And that was one of his questions, was that, you know, a lot of the pictures that they had released didn't have the inherent problems that would have shown up on photographs of that time period. But unfortunately, he was interrupting a little bit too much, so he didn't get into it like, you know, was hoping we could.
I wish I heard that. No, I didn't.
Yeah.
Well, let me put it to you this way. What most people don't realize is the cameras that the astronauts brought to the moon were standard Hasselblad. They weren't modified in any way to accommodate the harsh lunar surface conditions, right?
Well, that was part of his discussion. He didn't have, they didn't have cameras that could work through some of the radiation and
yeah,
things.
Yeah,
like, right.
Exactly.
Right.
So, I mean, on that basis alone, we have to write it off, because look at the problems that they would have encountered here. On the lunar surface, first of all, you have extremes of cold and hot. If you're in the open sunlight, it's about 200 degrees Fahrenheit, and if you're in the shade, it's about 300 below. So take your pick. The film would have either fried or frozen and cracked. And yet you look at these pictures, they're perfect.
Well, that was part of what he was getting into.
Sure.
So, yeah.
And, but there's more problems than that. You've got the radiation. Mm-hmm. You know, the moon doesn't have any atmosphere to filter out solar and extrasolar radiation. So the radiation would have penetrated right through that camera body with no hesitation at all. That thin sheet of metal would not have posed any threat or resistance to the radiation. It would have exposed the film right through the camera door.
Right, but it sounds like they would have worked through that now with the digital photography they have. That wouldn't be the problem.
Sure. But not back then.
No, it didn't sound like
it. You know, here's another problem. When they were shooting those cameras, they were mounted on their chests. They didn't hold them up to their eyes because they had the helmets on. They couldn't see through the viewfinder. So they had them mounted on their chest, and they were aiming blindly. And yet you look at the pictures, and they're all centered. They're all focused perfectly. They're all the focal lengths are perfectly adjusted. How can that be?
Right. And
you know, they should be crooked and you know, badly angled and you know, out of focus. It's just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we could go on with that all night. That's
right, right.
But it's just yet another lie that we've been told, you know. So it's not a question of how many things have they lied to us about. It's really a question of how many things have they told us the truth about. In fact, I got a list right here. You want to hear it?
Yeah, but can I just take a break here just quickly here?
Oh, sure.
Okay, this is KHEN LP 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest with Melody, and my guest tonight is Charles Giuliani, and we're kind of just exploring a lot of different avenues and questions out there that's going on with our world. Okay. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, so like I was saying, I was just going to go through a list here. It's much easier to go through a list of things we haven't been lied to about than things we have. So here's the list I come up with of things we haven't been lied to. And there we go. That was quick and easy, see? I'm telling you. I'm not even exaggerating. It's unbelievable. You know, I've looked into all kinds of different subjects, even ancient history. Well, I started to talk about the ancient Indian text. Maybe I should pick up.
Yeah, do that. That would sound interesting.
But, you know, before I do that, just to mention, you know, seriously, every subject, whether it's theology, good heavens, the lies are through the roof there. There isn't anything that mainstream religion isn't lying to people about. You know, they profess to follow this book, the Bible, and whether you believe in the Bible or not doesn't matter. When you actually read it for what it says, it's totally out of harmony with what is being taught in these big-name churches, but that shouldn't surprise us because they're steepled corporations is what they are. They're not even churches. You know, they're government-created entities, so naturally they're corrupt from the start, so should we be surprised that they're lying to people? But you can't look to mainstream anything if you want to understand anything. You've got to be your own investigative journalist. You've got to look into things for yourself. And, you know, even ancient history, we've been lied to about that. They want us to think that the further back in time you go, the more ignorant people were. Why? They had the same brain cavity that we have, the same brain size. You know, I would argue they were even probably smarter than we are, that man has degenerated over the years, not advanced. You can certainly say that about moral standards, can't you? If man was advancing, why wouldn't his moral character keep up with his intellectual development, you know?
It has a tendency to go down to the lowest common denominator.
Yeah. Oh, sure. We're going right back to the Dark Ages, the way we're heading right now. But anyway, the further back you look in history, you find man was highly advanced. For example, we don't have the ability today to manipulate stone blocks that weigh 2 million pounds. 2 million pounds. There are stones that are part of the Baalbek temple structure in Lebanon that actually weigh 2 million pounds. We couldn't budge anything like that except to blast it into 100 pieces, and then we could move it, you know. What I mean, how did they do this? There are rocks that weigh hundreds of tons up, you know, in the Andes, for example, in Peru, and in Bolivia. These stones were quarried up and over another mountainside. You know, they were quarried, dragged over one mountain range, across rugged terrain, over a river, and then up another mountain, and placed at the top of this mountain in, you know, at levels that today you can't even breathe in. You know, the elevation is so high, the oxygen is very low. So just, you know, walking up there is difficult to breathe. But can you imagine heavy labor hauling these heavy stones? Forget it. You'd die from lack of oxygen. You couldn't do it. And yet there are these stones, a testament to an amazing technology that we do not have today. It's such an insult to the ingenuity and, integrity of the ancients to say that they were primitive. No, they weren't. They were far more advanced than we were. They could do things that we cannot reproduce today. And they're lying to us. They don't want you to know that. For several reasons, they want us to think that we are at the pinnacle of development today, so that you will have faith and confidence in modern man, as he lies to you and gets you to, you know, take their medications if you have any stress or mental health problems, or if you're stressed because a loved one dies. Imagine that. For thousands of years, you know, tens of thousands, whatever, man has lived in this world and dealt with death. Sure, it's a traumatic thing, but, you know, in time you move on and you get over it, right? But no, not that you get over it, but you know what I mean. You learn to go on. But no, today they have you convinced that, oh, you're depressed? Oh, we've got just the thing for you. And so, whereas, you know, within a year or so, you can go on with your life again, or a few months or whatever, you know, now you're on for 20, 30, 40, 50 years on this dope, going broke and being lied to that you're getting a cure for your ailment, when in reality, is it any different than hitting the bottle? You know? Oh, don't turn to the bottle. That's not going to help you with your problems. Instead, take this medication. It'll have the same effect. Convince you that it's helping you, but it's not. But I'll make a lot of money off it in the meantime. Unbelievable. By the way, hitting the bottle is probably less harmful to your mental health than a lot of these pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, but, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah. But coming back to the... we're all over the map here tonight, but, you know, it's all connected eventually. But what fascinates me is the ancient Indian texts, like the Mahabharata, for example.
I've never heard of it.
This is something. In fact, if you email me, I can send you my recent, you know, the transcripts from the show that I did on this couple months back. But in that document, like I said, there's other ancient documents from pretty much every culture around the world that are, you know, tell a similar story, but none of them go into the detail like this ancient Indian text. It describes a flying craft called the Vimana.
Now, is this East Indian or...
Right, yeah, okay, yeah, okay. India, okay. Yeah. So, the place where all of our jobs are being sent to. But anyway, it describes this flying craft called the Vimana. Now, it's not talking about some fairy tale. You know, there's no mention here of flying green elephants with pink polka dot wings. You know, it's very scientific sounding. It's very matter of fact. It's a given that these things existed. And it describes, in one chapter, it describes the battle between two rival factions in India. And it says that when they engaged from the air in these flying craft, one of the kings ordered the forbidden weapon called the Ignaya weapon to be utilized. And he said when the weapon, or the text says that when the weapon hit the ground, a great incandescent cloud of smoke and fire rose to the heavens. It said that everything within a, whatever the term was for measuring distance, you know, the equivalent of, you know, 100 miles or whatever. Uh-huh. Everything within a 100-mile radius was incinerated. It said that the survivors grew deathly ill. Hair and nails fell out. Foodstuffs were poisoned. People ran to the river to wash themselves from the poison ray. You know, it just goes on and on to describe what you would expect from a nuclear fallout, right?
Right.
Interestingly enough, in recent years, when India first began their nuclear tests, they named it the Ignaya Project. Did you know that Oppenheimer, who worked on the Manhattan Project, he was asked after how it felt to be part of a scientific team that helped develop the world's first atomic bomb. You know what he said? Well, the first in modern times, anyway. It turns out that Oppenheimer was a Sanskrit scholar and was very familiar with texts like the Mahabharata. He believed that the ancients had developed this technology and they were just rediscovering it.
Huh.
Well, guess what? In the area where this battle is said to have taken place, it's right near the, you know, the Ganges, right in that area were two ancient cities that were exhumed in the past 100 years. One is called Mohenjo-Daro and the other one's called Harappa. And what they discovered is that the streets of the city were laden with skeletons that were haphazardly laid out, you know, all up and down the streets, and they showed signs of charring, and they actually registered relatively high in radioactivity, even after, what is it, 4,000 or 5,000 years. They still had a high level of radioactivity. So, I mean, it's obvious what went on here. Some of the stones in this city, in fact, quite a few of the stones, were vitrified, which means that, you know, the outer millimeter or so layer was melted. You can see where some of the stones had dripped and drizzled over each other and were stuck together. The only thing known that can produce that kind of heat would be a volcanic eruption, but there's no volcanoes in the area, and volcanoes wouldn't melt just the outer millimeter layer. It would melt the stone through and through.
Right.
It would blacken it. These stones weren't blackened. They were just coated with this molten rock material that, you know, had melted it just on the outer surface. That's what you would expect. In fact, they also found vitrified sand. This is what was produced when they did the nuclear tests out in the Nevada desert and, you know, the New Mexico desert. The sand became glazed with this thin sheet of molten material. The sand had melted on the surface. And it even turned a funny endemic greenish color. And this is what you find in the desert there in India, and there's other places in the world, too, in Egypt, in the Gobi Desert, and in these same areas there are ancient records telling of similar battles that had taken place. So, I mean, you know, you put all this together, and you start seeing a pattern emerging here that just doesn't coincide with... But, you know, you talk to mainstream academics about this, and they'll of course, laugh, and, oh, that's just ridiculous. But you look at the text, you look at some of the physical evidence that has been exhumed. You go over to Colombia, for example, and there were a number of gold-cast artifacts that look exactly like modern Delta Wing jets. In fact, I ordered a copy of one of them that's on display down in a museum down in Colombia. I actually got it off of eBay a couple of weeks ago. When I saw it, I'm like, wow, I got to get this. And I'm thinking, oh, geez, I probably won't win the bid, you know. So I kept following over the next several days. Nobody else was bidding on it, and I figured, gee, maybe nobody else knows what this is, so maybe I'll win the bid, you know? And I did. Apparently nobody else recognized it for what it was, but it's a copy of one of the... I'd never seen it on for sale anywhere before, so I was pretty pleased to get it. But it's an exact duplicate reproduction of one of these items that's, you know, in the museum. You look at this thing, it looks like a modern child's airplane toy.
Hmm.
You know, is this a model of an ancient flying craft? I would argue yes, because it's perfectly aerodynamically designed. It has, you know, the tail fin, and just like a modern jet. And they even tested it in a wind tunnel. You know, they produced a balsa wood version of it, and it's you know, they said it's designed to fly at supersonic speed. And interestingly, it's found not too far from where the Nazca lines are carved in the desert floor. You know, these are lines that were etched out in the desert in Peru that stretch for, in some cases, you know, 50, 60 miles. What's interesting is today, even with modern surveying equipment, you can't reproduce etchings like that in the desert that long, because the curvature of the earth prevents you from even seeing that distance. You can't do it without an aerial perspective. But even more significant, you can't even see them and appreciate them without an aerial perspective. In fact, they weren't discovered until the 1940s when someone actually flew over the area and saw them for the first time for what they were. They knew that these paths were there. They just thought they were roadways or something, ancient paths, you know. They realized, no, these are giant pictures, birds and monkeys and whatnot. You know, so how did they put them there without an aerial perspective, A, and B, why would they put them there at all if you can't see them from the ground? There's no place high enough to get an aerial perspective like that. In fact, even mainstream academia now is admitting that they had to have had air flight, but all they are willing to consent to is, you know, hot air balloons. But they won't admit to any kind of mechanical flying device, even though local legends and legends from around the world and things like the Mahabharata describe in precise detail flying craft of that nature, you know, high-tech, you know. It describes the Vimana as being iron birds that, you know, when they took off to the skies, they spit fire and roared like a lion. By the way, people will say, well, how come we don't have actual remains of these aircraft? Well, you know, if you were to go to the jungles of Vietnam today, you'd see some remains of U.S. planes that had crashed there. And you know what you would see left of them? Just a frail, rusted-out frame. You know, the skins are all stripped off. It's all corroded away. If you go in another 40, 50 years, you won't even see the rusted frame left. There'll be nothing left of them. Gone. That's just 100 years. What do you think a few thousand years would do to them?
Well, it kind of brings to mind, you know, if these guys are willing to control our history and the information that we have now, can you imagine that if they had that kind of information, it was, you know doggone well they would have hid that away, too.
Sure. So they want to limit us. They want to hem us in, keep us dumbed down. Looking to them, they're the masters, you see, and thinking that we are in the best society that humankind has ever seen in all of history. And you know, so we look to modern man as being the most civilized, the most intelligent, the most advanced, and there couldn't be a way better than this. And this is why, you know, they go after people like Chavez, because he's bounced out the big corporations. His people are living very comfortable there, have much better living standards than here in the United States. They really do. And, I mean, they're paying 12 cents a gallon down there for gas. They're living quite happily, quite comfortably. The corporations aren't driving them into poverty. And Bush wants the man dead. You know, he ordered the CIA to beef up efforts down there. In fact, now they've got, a potential problem arising with Colombia. It's all CIA orchestrated. You see, he's not any threat to them militarily, obviously. But he's an ideological threat. They can't have someone like that running a successful nation that makes us look bad. So they got to destroy him. They got to take him down. They got to discredit him. They got to make him look evil. You got people like Pat Robertson. We need to get the CIA down there and take out Chavez, the evil man. There's your Christianity. Turn the other cheek for you. It's so sick. It's unbelievable.
Well, there's a talk show host that was on RBN, Josh Reeves, who's been getting into some of the ancient history, and he's trying to put together pieces of the puzzles, trying to say that there may be more than meets the eye on going into Iraq. And one of the first things that ended up being looted was these museums with these ancient antiquities.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the first things they did when they went in there. That was obviously an inside job. Who's going to be able to get in and out of there without getting fired at and know exactly what to go after, what the most important artifacts were? I mean, they went after the cream of the crop. And, you know, I can tell you where they're at. I know where they're at. David Rockefeller was a big-time fan of antiquities, as was his family going back several generations. I think if you want to know what happened to the lost treasures of Troy that were looted during World War II, you just go to Fifth Avenue in New York, you'll probably find them all there in his living room cases on display.
Hmm.
I'm sure there's a few other elites, too, that they trade off with each other, but I bet the bulk of that material is right there. They know where it is. They're hiding all kinds of stuff. I just saw an article today that Peru is accusing Yale University of housing 40,000 Machu Picchu artifacts that they looted from there over the past 100 or so years. Of course. And we all know Yale is home to Skull and Bones. And what is Skull and Bones? They're the modern-day pirates. I mean, in their own name, they're telling you who and what they are, what they represent. You know, that's the Jolly Roger flag that used to fly in the pirate ships. You know, instead of hijacking ships, now they hijack entire nations. They steal their resources. They steal their national treasures, hoard them in their pockets. And so every time we go into a country and invade it, if there's any precious archaeological treasures, there they go. And anything they can't steal, they destroy. Like, you know, we're in the ancient city of Iraq. A lot of our soldiers have looted the city and, you know, literally dismantled the buildings and used them to build, you know, bomb shelters. And, you know, it's just unbelievable. It's so disgusting. That's a loss not only to the Iraqi people, but to the whole world, really, because that's where civilization began, the Fertile Crescent.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's, of course, secondary to the human loss of life over there, but it's just another disgusting legacy that they've left us. Oh, what a mess.
Well, if these, I mean, we haven't gotten into the ultimate goal of these elites and what they're doing, not only with this one world order, but where they're going with the population control.
Oh, that's another thing, yeah, sure.
Do you think that those ancients were the same way?
What's that again?
I mean, if they've got these ruins that show that they had used these atom bombs, possibly, you know, it sounds kind of like we're moving in the same direction.
Yeah, you know, I venture to say they probably got a lot of the ideas for their modern high-tech toys from these documents. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that's available that we're not privy to. I mean, we know, for example, that the Vatican Library is housing, you know, thousands and thousands, probably millions of volumes, not only from the Middle Ages on up, but, you know, probably ancient texts as well that they're never going to let see the light of day. I'd like to open that Pandora's box and see what they're hiding down there. Freemasonry is big for this. You know, everybody knows that Freemasonry is hiding stuff away. They've got their little vaults. I mean, they've even made movies about it. A lot of it is sensationalized, but nevertheless, I'm sure they have a lot of ancient treasures, that, you know, a lot of ancient knowledge. What we do know is just a trickling, you know, stuff that managed to leak out that they weren't able to contain. But, well, I mean, look, for example, back in 1976, there was a diver down in off the coast of Rio de Janeiro. He was diving, you know, sponge fish diving, whatever. And he came across an ancient sunken ship. And he thought, wow, what is this? You know, so he started digging around, and he was pulling up ancient Roman amphora. You know, they were terracotta vessels that they would store whatever, oil or, you know, olive oil or wine in or whatever. He had them positively identified at several universities as Roman from probably like the first century A.D. There's no question what he was digging up was a Roman ship. In fact, he dug up some Roman coins. And when he brought it to the attention of the Brazilian government, he thought, wow, I'm going to be, you know, world famous now. This proves the Italians were here first, not the Portuguese, you know. The next thing you know, they're demonizing him in the press, saying he's, you know, a huckster, he's making this all up, you know, it's a hoax. And they went in there and exhumed the rest of that ship, cordoned off the area, wouldn't allow anybody else in there. I mean, it's just, you know, this is a cover-up. They don't want the public to know this. So how many other things like this have gone on over the years? You know, how many other finds? There was a story printed in the local Arizona paper back in 1909 about a team of Smithsonian scientists that had explored this cave in a remote part of the canyon, Grand Canyon. And they said that they found Egyptian artifacts.
Hmm.
And, you know, they quoted several Smithsonian scientists that had worked on the dig. And then, you know, later they tried to get the Smithsonian to comment. Several people contacted them. They wanted to follow up. Denied. And, you know, now to this day, nobody knows where the cave is, if, you know, if it existed at all. But it wouldn't surprise me that they, you know, be lying and covering this up, you know.
So what you're saying is that a lot of the ancient civilizations were probably over, you know, roaming all the continents.
Oh, sure, yeah. There's an abundance of evidence of that. I mean, it's laughable that they absolutely will make no allowance for, you know, well, I mean, now they'll say that the Norse were here, you know, Eric the Red and his son. Who was it? Leif Erikson, yeah, the son of Leif Erikson. They'll admit now that they were over here probably about 1000 A.D. that they had come to Newfoundland and established a colony there. They admit that, although they really don't reflect it in their textbooks. You know, they still talk about Columbus being the first, which is ridiculous. Columbus actually used a lot of the ancient notes of travelers before him. He knew that there was land across the ocean. It wasn't flat, you know. The earth wasn't flat. But anyway, but other than that, that's about it. They won't admit that, for example, that the Romans came here, even though a diver found that ship off the Rio de Janeiro coast. They won't admit to the Egyptians having been here, even though they left very clear, undeniable fingerprints in ancient Mexican art. The Olmecs, for example, the Maya. Ancient people of India were here. You know, they've got, from Colombia, for example, they found some clay pots that have swastikas on them. The original origin of the swastika was from India. And they've also found associated with that clay carvings of people wearing, you know, turbans, and the facial features look Indian. You look at this and you'd swear it was, you know, found in India.
So as far as
the Egyptians go, a lot of the religious beliefs, practices, symbols, this book I'm working on called An Alternative View of the Distant Past, I've got quite a few pictures I've been collecting over the years that show, you know, Mayan priests wearing headdresses that absolutely could not have been independently invented. It's Egyptian all the way.
So do you have any theory of who might have been the first peoples to have been coming over here?
You know, it's almost impossible to tell. I mean, at one point or other, every culture left their traces here. But, I mean, we do know that, you know, one of the earliest, if not the earliest civilization was from Babylon or Sumer, and they left their traces here. So, yeah, if you wanted to nail it down to the very first, it was probably them. And, you know, this was a very rich land, still is in some senses, but, you know, a lot of the gold mines that are here have been well picked over by now. But originally, Peru was extremely rich in gold. North America, especially around the Great Lakes, was very rich in copper. And we know that in ancient times, millions of tons of copper were mined out of the Lake Michigan area. Millions of tons. Huge, huge mines were discovered, and massive portions of earth were removed from their copper, was removed from there. The natives here almost never used copper. I mean, they found a few little trinkets in some of the burial mounds, but not enough to anywhere near account for all the missing copper. Where did it go? Well, we know there was a thing called the Bronze Age. It was brought over to Europe. And we have many stone records, you know, writing in stone, telling of Phoenicians having come here, for example, and traded with the natives. I mean, they found Barry Fell. He was he's dead now, but he was a Harvard professor. He translated a lot of these glyphs up in Peterborough, up in Canada. And sure enough, I mean, there's this Ogham script and other ancient texts right there on the cliff walls, and, you know, telling of, you know, trade that was going on. The Tifnag language was another one that, you know, the Basques were here, the ancient Libyans were here. There was a massive trade going on. He dug up similar things in some islands off the coast of Maine. In fact, one of the stones he dug up said it was a trade port for the Phoenicians, a Phoenician trade port. So, you know, where their ships would land. There were other trade ports, you know, obviously on the island, but this particular section was just for Phoenicians. They would come and get, you know, their items. And, you know, this went on, off and on, over thousands of years. And what happened is, you know, a lot of them kept this secret. In fact, the Phoenicians were very secretive about what their sources were for a lot of their goods. They didn't want any competition, you know. In fact, it was a known fact for almost 1,000 years that nobody dared cross the area of the Straits of Gibraltar because the Phoenicians dominated it, and they basically sink you and kill you if you tried to go out beyond. They didn't want you out in the Atlantic. Well, why? What were they hiding? Because that was the source of probably a lot of their gold and other things that were not available. You know, a lot of fruits, a lot of vegetables are native to the Americas. Your tomato, that was native. The only place you can get it in the ancient world was here. The mango, the watermelon, the gourd. What else? Good heavens, there's a whole list.
Imagine corn.
Sweet potato is another one. You know, I mean, I could go on and on. So the Americas was a very rich source for food, for minerals, copper, gold, you know, on and on and on. So this stuff was being brought over there by the hordes. And, you know, the Phoenicians were one of the biggest traders. They didn't want that secret. So it's only natural that it was forgotten because they didn't keep record. They didn't want it known, right? But they left their presence here. They found in Brazil, in the Amazon, for example, stone records, you know, writings of, you know, in ancient Phoenician script, talking about how, you know, they had come here to trade, you know. I can go on for hours with things like this. The evidence is overwhelming. It's everywhere. You know, the Olmecs made these giant stone heads. To date, we found about a dozen of them, weighing, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 tons. Huge chunks of basalt, the size of your living room, carved with obvious Negroid features. You know, the large lips and the big cheekbones and the curly hair. And I mean, you look at them and you'd swear that these were from, you know, South or Central Africa or something. They're from Mexico. They date to, you know, as early as 2000 B.C. You know, how did the Mexicans, the ancient Mexicans that were supposedly isolated from the other parts of the world, how did they carve these obvious Negroid-looking faces, unless they had actually seen Negroes? You know, there's also Chinese features in some of their carvings. I mean, you look at it and it's like, yeah, that can't be anything else. I mean, they even had, you know, the goatee beards. Native Americans don't even grow facial hair. But here are these obviously Chinese-looking eyes with goatee beards, you know. But no, they weren't here. A lot of the pottery, the designs carved on their pottery or painted on their pottery shows very, very similar, striking-looking features that were found in motifs and so forth that were found in ancient Chinese art. You know, you just put this all together, and it's laughable. I mean, I laugh at mainstream academia when they say that, don't know the ancient. Is this they were not even intelligent enough or skilled enough to make a journey across the Atlantic? Never mind the Pacific, the Atlantic. It's only, you know, the closest distance between the easternmost point of South America and the westernmost point of Africa is only about 1,500 miles. Yet we know that the Phoenicians circumnavigated the whole coast of Africa in, like, you know, 2,500 B.C., a distance of 15,000 miles, and in many cases crossing very dangerous seas, yet the distance from, you know, Africa to South America at its closest point, again, is only 1,500 miles. It's not dangerous sea. As a matter of fact, as confident as the ancient Phoenicians were with ocean travel, they didn't even need any skills, because when you hit certain areas where there's trade winds, you can sit back and take a nap for, you know, a few weeks or, you know, a month and a half or whatever, and the trade winds will just carry you across. You don't even have to guide the ship, you know? And yet they're saying, nope, they didn't have the capacity to do it. They didn't know what get out of here. We now know that the Polynesians were all over the Pacific. They left their traces everywhere, from Hawaii down to Easter Island and, you know, New Guinea. I mean, all over the place. So, you know, why weren't the Phoenicians able to do this? Why weren't the Egyptians? Why weren't the Greeks? They had ships that were far more seaworthy than the dugout canoes of the Polynesians. You know what I mean? These people are just absolute jokes. They really are. I laugh at mainstream academia. You know, they can call me all the names they want in the book, but they're the ignoramuses. In many cases, it's willful ignorance. They just want to keep their jobs.
Well, some of them, in a sense, it's like they kind of act as their own gatekeepers.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, some of them honestly probably don't believe it because they were indoctrinated with the same lies they're pawning off on people now. But the truth is, even if they are aware, and I'm sure a great many are, they're not going to say anything because they don't want to risk losing their academic reputation and, you know, probably their job. You know, it's too much riding on it, so it's so much easier just to go along with the paradigm, keep your job security, and flex your economic muscle in front of people to impress them. Oh, I have my PhD. But all they're selling you is just gunk. You know, they're preventing you from uncovering some fascinating things from history. You know, in my book, Alternative View of the Distant Past, I delve into a lot of other things. I talk about, you know, the whole dating method that they employ as far as for dating fossils. The C-14 that they use for dating archaeological sites is fairly accurate, although there's even problems there. But when it comes to dating ancient fossils, there's nothing there to hang a hook on. It's a joke. It's laughable. And, you know, you don't need to be a scientist to figure it out. When they date a dinosaur bone, for example, and why I argue this in my book is because I want to, you know, I point out that ancient records, amongst other things, ancient records tell us that there was a colossal global catastrophe, a flood, if you will, that occurred in the relatively recent past. And one of the proofs of that, besides, you know, the human records of it all over the world, every culture has the records of this flood, but we have the geological evidence of it. You know, we have the world's great fossil formations, for example. Everywhere you go on the planet, every continent is loaded with 70% sedimentary rock, and those sedimentary formations are loaded with fossils. There's no accounting for these formations except a colossal amount of water depositing these layers with all of this organic remains that are perfectly preserved, sometimes down to the cellular level. You know, only a flood can account for that, a massive flood that buried this stuff before there was any chance for it to decompose, you know. But, you know, one of the most ridiculous ideas in modern science is that these things are millions of years old. Well, that's just not possible. Because when they date a fossil, they're not dating actually how old, say, the dinosaur bone is. They're dating the mineral. Because, you know, the bone is long since decomposed. There's no bone left in there. And even if there was, by their own admission, they couldn't date it anyway because the organic material, what they use in organic material is carbon-14, but carbon-14 has a very short life, short half-life. So there's no carbon-14 left in these fossils. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So they can't even use carbon-14. So they have to rely on inorganic materials to date organic remains, right? So when they date a dinosaur bone, again, they're not dating organic material because, A, there really isn't any organic material left, and, B, there's no carbon-14 left in the organic material. So all they're dating is the mineral that has replaced the bone. How could that tell you how old the bone is or was?
I've kind of thought of that myself in the past.
The mineral existed long before it seeped into that bone to replace it. So even if their dating methods were accurate, and they're really not for a lot of reasons I don't have time to get into now, but even if their dating methods were accurate, all that can tell you is how old the mineral is that replaced the bone, but it can't tell you anything about how old the original bone was.
Right.
It's like going to a cemetery and digging up some bones from 200 years ago and dating the dirt around the bone and saying that's how old the bone is. The dirt was there long before the bones were buried there. You know what I mean? That's really what they're doing. And you look at this, and once you realize what they're actually telling you, all you can do is laugh because it's so childishly ridiculous. And yet they sell this to people as science. It's pathetic. The truth is, they don't know how old a dinosaur bone is any more than a five-year-old child that hasn't even started school yet. They don't. They have no idea. There is no scientific method for dating this stuff. And, you know, here's another joke, okay? All over the world is fossil formations that have what are called polystrat fossils. It's fossils that stand straight up in sedimentary layers that in some cases can be, you know, 60 feet high, like a petrified tree trunk. You can have a tree trunk, and, you know, many places in the world have this phenomenon, like up in Nova Scotia, for example. There's some down in Tennessee. You'll have these huge fossil cliffs, layer after layer after layer, right? And then you'll have these tree trunks, petrified tree trunks, standing straight up in these layers that supposedly span time frames of, you know, 50, 60, 100 million years. You see the problem?
Mm-hmm.
How can you have a tree standing waiting to be buried for hundreds or tens of millions of years. That's what they're telling us, that it took millions of years for these cliffs to accumulate, these sedimentary cliffs. If that's the case, how do you have those trees standing up all that time? Obviously, that cliff that contains that 60-foot tree trunk had to have been laid down relatively quickly, right? Before the tree had time to rot. But they're telling us, nope, millions of years. Well, that ends it right there. That's not possible. Here's another thing. You know, you got formations like the Green River Formation, which spans areas of Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming. It's hundreds of miles long, in some areas, you know, 100 feet thick. And all through these layers, if you break them open, from the top layers all the way down to the lowest layers, doesn't matter, they're loaded with, amongst other things, fish. And whether you break open a layer way down the bottom or way up near the top, it doesn't matter. These fish are perfectly preserved. The bones are fully articulated in the same position that they were when the fish were alive. They show no sign of decomposition, the bones separating, breaking apart, nothing. They're perfectly preserved. How can that happen if these layers were systematically laid down over millions and millions of years? What they tell us is, oh, there was a drought, the fish died, and then there was a flood, a small local flood, and, you know, the river flowed again, and more fish died, and then there was a drought again, you know, the fish died, and then they were buried. This kept repeating itself over millions of years, right? Where can you go today and find a dried-out riverbed whose fish are just lying there waiting to be buried without their bones being scattered by the elements, by birds and other animals of prey? The bones are just going to sit there and remain fully articulated without showing any signs of decomposition. You know, when a fish dies, its bones begin to separate within an hour or two after its death. Even without the wind blowing or without predators picking the bones apart, right? Just to leave the fish there, the bones are so soft, you know, it's cartilage. They'll begin to break and pull apart within an hour or two after the fish is dead. Yet these fish are found by the millions without any bone out of place. Do you see how ridiculous this is?
Mm-hmm.
So I say to you, mainstream academia, you're a bunch of fools, or you're liars. In either case, I laugh at you. You know nothing. Paralyzed from the head down, that's what your PhD means. You know? I mean, it's so disgusting. We're lied to about everything. Like I said, it's much easier to mention what we're not lied to about. And I already gave you the list. Oh, it's sickening. You start uncovering this stuff, and it's like, how in the world can anybody with a rational thinking mind buy into any of this? But the average person buys into all of it.
Well, that's another thing. I was noticing on some of your guests that have been on your program, and was there a guy named Colin Ross?
Oh, sure. Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. I couldn't believe he brought us. I wasn't even aware of this until I talked with him, and then I've looked into it more since then. And yeah, sure enough, there's no basis for the chemical imbalance diagnosis that they give people, you know, to put them on meds. There's no such thing. It's just a fairy tale. They made it up. It's generated billions of dollars for the pharmaceutical companies, not to mention the psychiatry profession, you know.
Well,
there's nothing to it.
Have you seen that one interview that's on YouTube or Google where they're interviewing these psychiatrists and whatever at some kind of a seminar? And all of them pretty much say that you know, they've never cured anybody or...
Oh, yeah. No, that's a fact. Psychiatry to this day has never been able to boast even one cure. Not one. They don't cure anybody. There's no money in a cure. Well, you know, when you come right down to it, the medical profession, to a large extent, can say the same thing, although they have cured people. But for the most part, they don't cure either. They want to keep you sick. They want to keep you coming back. And I'll tell you right now, I've had a lot of success over the years with various problems. I've had health problems. For example, candida. I've had a problem with candida. I battled with for years until I finally got on an herbal program, and son of a gun, it went away. I had my dermatologist tell me, oh, no, you're going to be stuck with this for life. You're just going to have to keep coming back, and I'll renew your prescription for, what the heck was it, selenium sulfide or whatever it was. And, you know, all that does is just deal with the symptom. It's just a temporary relief, and you just keep coming back. I'll make more money. You know, either they don't know because they're just as dumbed down as their patients, or they do know and don't want you to know, and they just want to keep making money. In any case, the boys at the top know. Whether the doctor knows or not, who's telling you this stuff, doesn't matter. The boys at the top know. They know that you can cure this with natural herbs. They don't want you to know that, though, of course, because their system would collapse. So they keep you coming back. They just treat symptoms. It's kind of like, you know, you got some, you know, mentally handicapped guy who has a habit of hitting himself in the head with a hammer, and he keeps going back, and the doctor says, oh, yeah, I can see you've got a bump on your head. Well, here, take this aspirin. And then the next day he comes back, and it's still hurting. Take the aspirin. Do you think that doctor is going to tell the guy, hey, you know, it might be a good idea if you stop hitting yourself in the head with that hammer? That's the cause of the problem, right? No, they don't deal with the cause. They deal with, okay, you have a headache. Well, this is what you can do. Take this pill.
Yeah, that goes back to that same system, though.
What's
that? That all goes back to that system that you started talking about.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, we bounced all over the map, but guess what? We're right back to square one again. It's all the same problem. All of this stuff that we've been talking about really stems from the same source. It's the elites that are running the world, keeping us in ignorance. I mean, we didn't even touch on the food additives, you know. That's all a part of this, of course. If they can't get you on the psychotropics, they'll get you on the food additives. You know, you've got your... I mean, essentially, the whole population is on Prozac, whether they know it or not. You know, if you drink tap water, or if you use fluoride toothpaste, or if you get your fluoridated treatments there from your dentist every 6 months when you get your teeth clean, then you're on Prozac, because that's what Prozac is. It's fluoride. And what is fluoride? It was sold in the 19th century as rat poison. It's a known neurotoxin. It keeps the public apathetic, dumbed down, unable to think clearly, devastates your memory, and lo and behold, it doesn't even do anything for your teeth either. That's another fairy tale. It actually weakens your enamel, which of course is great for the dental industry, isn't it? It's unbelievable.
Yeah. No,
and then we've got aspartame. Why is it that aspartame suddenly became a harmless food additive in 1976, whereas prior to that the FDA refused to approve it? They said it was a deadly toxic chemical, and it is. It was originally used by the Pentagon back in the 60s as a chemical warfare agent. Now it's suddenly a harmless food additive. How did that happen? Well, Mr. Rumsfeld was hired by B.D. Searle. It used to hold the patent. Now it's held by Monsanto. But once he became their CEO, boom, overnight, suddenly now the FDA says, oh, it's not so bad after all.
It makes a good ant poison, too, by the way.
Oh, sure. It's just unbelievable. And, you know, they'll say fluoride is harmless, right? But, I mean, look at your toothpaste label. If you should ingest an amount more than what you ordinarily use to brush your teeth, call poison control immediately. That sounds like it's real harmless, doesn't it?
Well, it's. I thought that had a little bit to do with Rumsfeld, too, didn't it?
The fluoride? Mm. No, that goes back... That goes back to the 1930s, at least in this country. Anyway, that's when they started using it over here. Right at the same time, Hitler began employing it for the same reason.
Okay, right. Now, I understand what you're saying, but I mean its usage over here, I thought, had...
Oh,
some...
really? Mm-hmm. That could be. I don't even know, but I haven't heard that.
Okay.
Wouldn't surprise me.
I'm...
But, I mean, it was already in use before he came around. You know,
right. But it's a byproduct.
Diapers when that was... Well, actually, I understand he still probably soils his diapers now.
So it's a byproduct, though, of, like, the aluminum industry and uranium.
Yeah.
Right.
Isn't that nice? A toxic waste product they put in your... And kids, too. That's what's so disgusting. See, these guys have no conscience whatsoever. They don't care about destroying kids' lives. You think they care about adults? I mean, you know, we could talk about the fiasco of the Marisol. It's no longer being used now, thank God, but of course, don't worry, they'll come up with something even worse. But this was being used from the early 90s on. It was a mercury-laden preservative that they were putting in immunization shots. And it was known as a toxin already. You know, I mean, come on, mercury. It's mercury. And when they inject it, of course, into the bloodstream, it wouldn't go through the body's natural filtration system like the kidneys and the liver. You know, it went directly into the bloodstream, right to the brain. And so it was a huge surge beginning from 1995 when they really started heavily using it. Up until 2000, reported cases of autism in this country went up like 1,800%. And this was being... connected with the Marisol. Several independent scientists were saying, yeah, there's no question about it. This is mercury. Come on, it's a neurotoxin. Do you know what happened? a bunch of the pharmaceutical company heads, you know, from Eli Lilly, for example, that was heavily using this, along with Monsanto and a few others, met with heads of the CDC, the NIH, and the FDA. And the topic of the meeting, by the way, they met down at a private resort in Georgia. When else have we had big business and big government meeting together at a private resort in Georgia? That was the creation of the Federal Reserve back in 1910.
You're saying Jekyll Island there.
Yeah, sure. I don't. This wasn't Jekyll Island second time, but still, you know, it's interesting, a private resort in Georgia. Anyway, when they met, what came about as a result of that, instead of the government of regulators saying, hey, you guys are going to stop doing this, it's causing autism. No, they said, oh, don't worry, we don't want to hurt your profits, not to mention the government loves that kids are getting dumbed down. And you know, more autistic kids you get, the better for the human services industry. And so they said, oh, don't worry, we're going to produce a report stating that thimerosal is not harmful for children. They did. 2 months later, they started reporting around the country, a new government study shows that thimerosal, far from being harmful to your child's development, is actually beneficial. Oh, yeah. I guess all you CDC heads and are keeping a gallon jug of mercury in your refrigerator for your kids, right? They get thirsty, have them chug a lug. Not only did they do that, but they promised them that they were going to get legislation passed which would prevent parents from suing the pharmaceutical companies if their kids developed autism related to thimerosal. I mean, can you believe this? They never did get that passed, by the way. They tried several times and never did, thank God, and it went to Congress, but it doesn't matter now. They have finally taken it off the market. But you know what? They took it off the market not because it's been proven to be deadly or at least severely harmful to kids causing autism. No, they took it off the market because they said that there was a lot of paranoia regarding it. So, you know, just to quiet people's fears. Can you believe this? Because it didn't matter, because by the time they took it off the market, they'd already ruined millions of kids' lives and already made their profits back that they were hoping to get, you know.
What about the Gardasil?
What's that?
What about the Gardasil? Isn't that the one that they're given the, I think that's what it's called.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
for the girls, young girls?
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
Nice cancer-causing, you know, it's just, it's incredible. And shame on the parents that allow their kids to be subjected to this. There's no law that you have to get your kid immunized. It's another one of those little intimidation games, like they do with the income tax, like they do with the churches and the 501c3 thing. There's no law that requires this. It's just all fear factor. You know, I remember when I was in college, they tried to tell me that, you know, my immunization records weren't up to date and you're not going to be able to register and start classes tomorrow unless you can get us a doctor's note and get your records up to date. I says, no, I'm not getting a shot for anything. I said, I don't trust these immunization shots, and there's no law that says I have. So the nurse was real cocky. Well, I guess you're not going to be able to start school tomorrow. I says, oh, yes, I will. She's laughing. Huh? What makes you think that? I says, I'll be back here in 5 minutes, and you'll see. I think she was hoping that I was going to fall for the intimidation thing or, you know, that I didn't know what I was doing. I went right up to the president of the college. He was in a meeting. And he says, oh, I'm really busy right now. I says, well, let's put it this way. If you can't take care of this matter right now, I'm walking out this door and I won't be coming back here next year. They were hurting for students, you know. So